This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 2018, vast plumes of smoke erupted into the atmosphere from very large wildfires on a couple of continents. Will that make global warming worse? I've called Professor John C. Lynn from the Land-Atmosphere Interactions Research Group at the University of Utah. After studying and teaching in Canada, John Lynn got his doctorate in Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard. He is widely involved in the scientific community, including his role as a science team member with NASA. And Lynn is author or co-author of 10 peer-reviewed papers published just so far in 2018 alone. From Salt Lake City, Professor Lynn, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it's a joy to join you today.
All right, so I'm hoping to get an atmospheric view of this wildfire story. What happens when a large forest apparently vaporizes into the air?
A lot happens. We're all probably familiar with what happens on the ground. The various parts of the vegetation burn up or almost disappear, leaving a very charred landscape behind. But also a lot happens in the atmosphere. So different things get released into the atmosphere. So that includes the different aerosols that we call the particles that make it to the atmosphere. There's also various, I would say, pollutants that affect human health. There's also, of course, the greenhouse gases. The carbon that was stored in the form of wood and leaves in the vegetation get vaporized and they get turned into carbon dioxide. So that is a greenhouse gas that I'm sure you've talked many times in your program.
And this year in the journal Atmosphere, you and your colleagues published a paper about the difficulties of modeling forest fire smoke. What is the problem?
Well, the forest fires themselves generate heat, and that causes the atmosphere around the fires itself to change. So that causes sometimes pretty extreme what we call pyrocumulus clouds, that clouds that extend very high into the atmosphere. And that is often very difficult to model. So that's one example. Another way to think about it is the fires create its own weather, and that could affect exactly how far downwind the smoke plume reaches.
Well, I know when volcanoes erupt or even when nuclear reactors blow up, we know that a key factor is whether the particles and gases manage to rise as high as the stratosphere. John, why is that important?
Absolutely, yeah. The stratosphere, which is the layer of atmosphere above the lowest part of the atmosphere, which is the troposphere, so that layer is more stable. So if the particles from fires or volcanoes make it up to the stratosphere, they can hang around for a while. So there are famous examples like after the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, where the aerosols hung around for a year or two, and that caused a global cooling effect. So that is one of those very dramatic global phenomena that persisted for a year or two, but eventually these particles do go away. And we're back.
Do you know if that happened in this fire season this year?
I'm not aware of huge amounts of aerosols making it to the stratosphere from the fires. Those huge events from the fires are more on the rare side. So typically the smoke does still stay within the troposphere. So then they dissipate relatively quickly.
But this past summer, even in the troposphere, the smoke from the giant wildfires in Siberia was reported to have blown 5,000 miles across Canada as far as New England. Does that strike you as unusual transport in the atmosphere?
So those do happen, and that happens even if it doesn't make it into the stratosphere. What you're describing is long-range transport across the Pacific does happen even if the plume makes it only in the upper part of the troposphere. So maybe, I would say, over 10 kilometers above sea level. So that can still happen without making it all the way to the stratosphere.
And where does the ash and soot from wildfires in the northern hemisphere tend to end up? Do we know?
Were you thinking about fires, say, from Canada or?
Yes, Canada and the Boreal or in Siberia. Does it all go up to the Arctic and blacken glaciers and ice there or not?
That does happen, but plenty stay at lower latitudes as well. In fact, there's some emergent sort of research from different groups looking at long-term trends of these kind of particles, and there appear to be an increasing trend in these extreme events in the western U.S., for example, most likely due to fire. So there's a very likely scenario of increasing sort of fire activity, large intensive fires happening. I know B.C. was kind of a record year this year, right? I think it's, isn't it the sort of the most amount of burned area?
Yes, it either is this year or it tied with last year.
Yeah, these 2 years are quite pronounced, yeah.
We've had fire emergencies both years, and I personally, as my listeners are tired of hearing about, was smoked out for a couple of weeks, and we had fires right up on the hill above our house and so on. But anyway, you did mention a lot goes on when these fires happen, and I wanted to just touch on a couple of the lesser-known gases. I know that wildfires produce a lot of carbon monoxide. I've seen NASA maps showing huge spots of carbon monoxide. There was one right here in British Columbia during our fire emergency last summer. How long does carbon monoxide last in the atmosphere?
Carbon monoxide, or CO as we call it, lasts on the order of a month, depends on the season, but I would say a good rule of thumb is about a month. So it's not, I would say, super long-lived compared to some other gases, but it does hang around for a bit. Mainly it gets oxidized to CO2 eventually.
So can carbon monoxide also affect the climate?
In the sense that it eventually shows up as carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we are talking about. Yeah, so in the form of carbon monoxide or eventually CO2, the fires definitely produce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that is definitely a warming effect that one should think about from the fires. And perhaps this is a good time maybe to talk about your original question, what is the sort of net effect potentially of fires, warming or cooling. And that's where the discussion gets more complicated, because while the fires release a fair bit of greenhouse gas, they also have other effects. It depends on the time scale you're talking about. So it affects the landscape. The forests sometimes take quite a while to grow back after the fire. So then the question is, what happens to the landscape that it leaves behind? And perhaps surprisingly to some people, it could have a cooling effect. And that actually happens in some of the more northern latitudes, like in Canada, because the forests actually are less reflective than the landscape that they leave behind after they burn up. So there could paradoxically be almost a cooling effect from that perspective. So there are these competing effects from the greenhouse gases to the more reflective landscape that it leaves behind. So that's where careful calculations have to be done.
And what about the dimming effect from the smoke itself? I mean, it was cold here when it was densely packed with smoke.
So definitely there is a cooling effect perhaps right in the vicinity of the fire. The smoke can really block out the sun, yeah? So there's sort of a local cooling effect that would dissipate after a while as well. So that cooling effect wouldn't necessarily last. So the IPCC has done some careful calculations of the net effect of these aerosols that the fires emit. And there's sort of, it's kind of a cancellation. There's some cooling, but also some warming, and the last IPCC report arrived at what they call radiative forcing of roughly zero. So those are washing up. But the other effect I'm talking about, this albedo effect, the reflectivity of the ground, that can persist for a while because, as I said, the vegetation takes a while to grow back. And if we're thinking about the more northern latitudes, the formerly darkened surface would be turned into a reflective surface, especially if there's snow on the ground. So that's where perhaps we can see where this cooling can come from.
And another idea I've had, which is very unscientific, and I'm hoping you can help me out with it, is whether, I mean, we have a burst of carbon coming out of these fires as the tree trunks release all their carbon and goes into the air. Now, when that carbon arrives in the air, do we have an immediate heating effect, like a greenhouse effect, or does it take time for that to really happen?
Are you saying the carbon dioxide, does that immediately get to work in terms of trapping infrared radiation? Is that where we're getting at?
Yeah,
so that can take place pretty quickly, but we're well aware of the fact that that burst of carbon dioxide gets mixed really rapidly. So carbon dioxide is often referred to as well-mixed greenhouse gas. So while it's true that, let's say, in downtown Vancouver or right downwind of a fire, the carbon dioxide would be elevated, that relative increase is not that big compared to the background amount. So while it's true that it would get to work, but that effect is not that big. Yeah, so that net heating. But the aerosols, that cooling effect that you felt, I think you talked about, that could be felt pretty locally, very quickly. But that additional warming from the carbon dioxide is not that pronounced.
Well, thank you. That helps.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor John C. Lynn from the University of Utah. We're talking about wildfires, the atmosphere, and climate change. So in 2009, the respected Tasmanian fire scientist David Bauman published a paper where he estimated that fires of all kinds, including agricultural burning, produced greenhouse gases equivalent to 50% of human emissions. But other sources tell me that relatively low carbon contribution from wildfires in the U.S. compared to overall emissions. John, does carbon release from wildfires really matter compared to our fossil fuel burning?
Absolutely, if you're thinking about a global scale. And again, it depends on where you are. Let me go to some of the big fire releases. Indonesia is an example. So the amount of, I think, carbon dioxide released in the recent El Nino event, which was a huge one, the 2015-2016 event from Indonesia, was really big. I think there was a study that showed it rivaled some of the biggest fossil fuel emitting nations in the world just from fires alone from Indonesia. So that was quite a big event. So it does matter in the global sense. There are very big releases of carbon from wildfires. And these days, the biggest are in the tropics, like Indonesia or in the Congo in Brazil, for example, around the Amazon forest. So while they may not be as big in total as the total, let's say, combustion from coal or gasoline or natural gas, wildfire release is still very big. It's the same order of magnitude.
I was surprised when looking into this to find out how much of the planet does burn from time to time. A 2008 study of fires led by a Spanish scientist named Emilio Chuvieco, I hope I pronounced that correctly, found more than 30% of the global land surface has a significant fire frequency. So, I mean, almost a third of the planet burns from time to time. That must add a lot of urgency to the work that you and other atmospheric scientists are doing to track what this really means.
Yes. Yes, and this year was a big fire year in the western U.S., and as we just discussed, in British Columbia as well. The western U.S., I should now say western North America, is undergoing a fair bit of change, I think. And I should add that intersects with other sort of effects of climate change, and one big one is the insect damage that's affecting the forests of western North America. The beetle kills leaves a lot of fuel that can lead to catastrophic fires. And you add on top of that human suppression of wildfires over decades, and that leads to a lot of fuel sort of buildup. So even from the perspective of just safety and air quality, wildfires have a big impact. So that is not necessarily climate per se, but it certainly intersects with all the other consequences of climate change.
Well, let's talk about some of your other work. And on each Radio EcoShock show, we try to dive into the deep end at least once and maybe drown. So you are the editor of a book on Lagrangian modeling of the atmosphere. Who is Joseph-Louis Lagrange, and why are you specializing in this work developed in Prussia in the 1700s?
Well, it's Mr. Lagrange, but he's a smart guy, so his name shows up in a lot of things. So this Lagrangian book that I was involved in, and that we make heavy use of, is talking about specific kind of modeling of the atmosphere. And the way it works is there are two basic kinds of modeling that takes place in the atmosphere. One is called Eulerian, named after another famous guy, Euler. And the way that works is you stay stationary, you observe and try to model the atmosphere as it passes you. The other is you go along with the flow in the atmosphere, and that's the Lagrangian kind of modeling that I'm involved in with a lot. And that kind of model can be used to trace wildfires, today's topic. It could be used to trace plumes of pollution and nuclear accidents, all sorts of stuff. So it's been a very, very useful way to understand the atmosphere. One interesting sort of perspective that my group has taken is to do the atmospheric modeling backward in time and try to trace where the air that we measure comes from. So that becomes really useful. Let's say we want to understand where the smoke that we breathe, let's say in Vancouver, comes from. So we trace the air backward in time using the Lagrangian method. We can map out specific parts of the landscape that contributed that pollution. So that's the kind of application of the Lagrangian modeling.
Yes, we found that we got some dust from eastern China by that kind of research, I think.
Yeah, it's very widely used now, those kind of models.
And I've also noticed, John, that some of the work published by you and your research group is local. It's about Utah. And I'm wondering, maybe that's where the new climate science is going, that we need less now about these grand global averages and more of a focus on the direct impacts where we are.
Yeah, I think that's been perhaps a bright spot, even in the policy realm as well. So as we all know, the federal action on climate in the U.S. has been
pathetic,
kind of quiet in recent years. But there's been a lot of action on the grassroots level, at the local municipal level as well. Lots of cities in North America and beyond around the world have very ambitious, say, climate mitigation plans. A lot of cities, let me just take Salt Lake City example, have very ambitious plans. Salt Lake City is trying to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 80% in a few decades. So 80%, that's a very ambitious plan. So that's where this local research can hopefully help inform and assess different means to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just as a really basic example, we're measuring carbon dioxide around the city of Salt Lake City. It's actually one of the longest-running urban CO2 monitoring networks in the world. So from that perspective, we can measure from the atmosphere how much carbon dioxide is being pumped into Salt Lake City's atmosphere. And we can see how it's changing over time. And if cities have sort of very ambitious plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then we should be able to measure it in the atmosphere. So that's kind of an exciting new front in the climate research, becoming quite local and potentially engaging the stakeholders and policymakers as well. And once we're talking about, say, city scale, there's a lot of opportunity to engage the public or different people, because we all understand different parts of the city, and that's where we can also tie in with sort of people's individual efforts to try to help.
Have we reached the point yet where any of our listeners can look up how much CO2 is coming from their city?
It's getting there, and there are some nice websites I can share with you, like I can dig it up and email it to you at some point. There are some estimates of different cities' emissions. And I believe where you're at, Vancouver, is also, there's a fair bit of work done on that front. Some people at University of British Columbia that I know have done similar kinds of work. So, yeah, it's sort of a growing field. There's a fair bit of action on the urban front. There's hope that this is where the research and the public and the different stakeholders can really meet.
Well, great. If you'd send me those links, I'll put them in my show blog. And I'm also going to look in to see whether Europe is doing the same thing. There's a lot of work that could come from that and some activism, as you say. Now, John, when I talk with scientists in various fields, I'm beginning to sense a kind of race developing. And that race is between greenhouse gases produced directly by us humans versus a whole collection of carbon sources and feedbacks coming directly from nature. Right now, we're the biggest polluter, but do you think nature could take over as the major engine of further warming?
I really hope not, because we're already pumping a lot of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So there are some worries. There are some big stores of carbon, for example, that could be destabilized as climate change occurs. Examples include the tropical rainforest, the Amazon, for example, lots of carbon there. There are some climate models that do predict as the climate warms, it could also get drier in the Amazon. And there are some climate models that simulate catastrophic kind of collapse of the Amazon rainforest, which means all that carbon is going to be released to the atmosphere. So that those are really cases where the natural emissions could potentially rival those of the humans. I hope not. There's also the carbon that are found in the permafrost or peatlands in Canada, let's say. If those do melt and dry out, that could also be a big pulse of carbon to the atmosphere. So, yeah, so the potential is there. I'm hoping we don't get there. But I think you're right. There's sort of a general concern. Sometimes it's referred to as tipping points, where you have very large changes that could happen. Still sort of instigated by the human release, but where the natural could have a big response to that.
John, do you think it's fair to say the atmosphere is more complex and fragile than we knew?
It's definitely more complex. I might shy away from fragile, but it's complex, and it responds in ways that could be surprising. And clouds, for example, is another great example. I believe you just talked to my colleague, Tim Garrett, right?
That's right, yes.
And the clouds are a perfect example. There's lots of things that affect clouds, and whether clouds are warm or cool or increase in extent or decrease depends a whole host of variables, including wildfires, which could affect clouds. So it is definitely very complicated, but it makes it interesting as well.
And there's rivers of air up there. I just watched a video from University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith, and he was showing this Beaufort Sea gyre both in the atmosphere, but then that starts to spin the sea below it. So there's a real interaction, and I think your team name shows that, between both the earth and the air, but also the sea and the air.
Oh, yes. And my colleague here, Thomas Reichler, also shows the coupling between the stratosphere and these lower layers. So these layers are seem somewhat separate, but they can be coupled, and that makes it even more complicated and interesting.
And as we finish up here, what are some of the other things you're working on these days?
One thing I'm working on is dust. So I would like to understand the transport and the origins of dust. Again, using these Lagrangian models we talked about. But there's a fair bit of concern about a dust transport in the western U.S. And some of that is due to some of the lakes potentially drying up. We have a big one next door called the Great Salt Lake. And right now the aerial extent of the Great Salt Lake is quite low. And that's a combination of human use of water that flows into the lake and also climate change. And that could expose lake beds that could have dust emissions to the atmosphere. And then the dust in the atmosphere, once it's deposited on snow, we're finding out could melt it at a faster rate. And that could be a feedback loop as well. So that's been one other project that I've been working on right now. And another project I'm working on is the use of satellites to determine the carbon emissions from cities from around the world. So NASA has a satellite called OCO2, Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, that's orbiting the Earth, measuring carbon dioxide from around the world. So we're trying to make use of that to figure out how much emissions are happening in different parts of the world. And pretty soon, next year, NASA will be launching OCO3, which will be on the International Space Station. And that will be pretty exciting because that sensor is somewhat different. It'll be able to look at individual cities in detail and really tell us much more about what different cities are emitting.
From the University of Utah, we've been speaking with John C. Lynn, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences. I'll put links to John's webpage and some key papers we've discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. With 18 peer-reviewed papers out this year and more in press, John, are you the kind of person who eats lunch in your office?
Uh-oh, how did you guess? I do. But that's partly because my wife brings me wonderful lunches, so I get to enjoy it in my office, too.
Well, thank you for spending your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a joy.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.